This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Imagine working and not getting paid. Well, that would be illegal, right? But according to Kim Bobo, who coined the phrase wage theft, it happens to working people in this country every single day. 26% of America's low-wage workers don't get paid the minimum wage that they are entitled to by law. Three-quarters of the country's workforce is cheated out of overtime pay. And then there are thousands of workers who are deliberately misclassified as independent contractors instead of employees so the company can avoid paying them benefits. This is wage theft, and it has been called America's silent crime wave. Kim Bobo is executive director of the Interfaith Work Justice. She's the author of several books, including Wage Theft in America. She's in the Triangle to speak at Duke Divinity School tomorrow, September 27th. But first, she joins me in the studio today. Kim Bobo, welcome to State Things.
Good
to
have
you here. Give us an idea of the scope of wage theft in America. How much is there?
Well, it's literally billions of dollars. You know, no one really knows exactly how much money. I did a little back of the envelope kind of estimate based on the larger studies that have been done. My guess is it's somewhere in the range of $100 billion a year stolen annually from workers. It's primarily low-wage workers, but it's also middle-income workers as well. So it is a serious problem, and it's in sectors that really are all around us, right? So it's not somewhere else. It's restaurants. It's landscaping, it's car wash, it's nail salons, it's residential construction. It's, you know, it's services that you and I use all the time, and they are just widespread violators of the wage and hour laws.
Now, it sound those that you named all sounded like small businesses to me. Is this restricted to small businesses?
It absolutely is not. I would say it is. There's lots of small businesses that aren't following the law, but you also have Walmart, the nation's largest employer, that has settled 65 class action lawsuits for shaving of hours. So managers would be under great pressure to keep wages down. They would literally go into the timesheets, and if workers said, oh, I work 44 hours, 45 hours, they would shave it off and say, oh, they only worked 40 hours. I mean, they settled 65 class action lawsuits on this. So, again, it's not just a problem for small employers.
And you talked about, to take another big employer, FedEx is a pretty good example of a very large company that's using a practice that has been challenged from time to time, but still nets that company a lot of money.
Absolutely. They call their drivers in states where they've been allowed to, they call them independent contractors, even though they decide what routes they're doing, what hours they work, what packages get delivered. They clearly, in terms of the common sense definition of independent contractors, aren't independent contractors. They work for FedEx. And so they've, again, been settling suits around the country, but it is a huge problem. Or you have companies like Pulte Homes, which is one of the nation's largest home builder. We did a number of religious delegations out to their work sites. We didn't find a single worker who was called an employee. They were all called independent contractors, even though they only worked on the homes that Pulte was building. So again, it's widespread from some of our nation's largest employers.
So you talk about these abuses, not paying the minimum wage. There's a law that says this is the minimum wage. It sets a wage. How do you get away with that? How can you not pay the minimum wage?
Well, it is quite shocking, actually. Unfortunately, it really does happen. I was riding in a car the other day with a young woman. I mean, she's a senior in college, you know, trying to work her way through college. And she was brought in as a manager at a restaurant. And she was told, well, at first you're going to be on a trial period. You're going to work 20 hours a week. I'm going to pay you $2.75 an hour. Okay, that's fine. So she does her trial period for a couple weeks. The guy says, you know, I really like you. I want you to go to full time. And, you know, we'll talk later about exactly what your wages will be. He kept paying her $2.75. She worked 70 to 80 hours a week. And every week she's saying, well, when are you going to pay me? Oh, we'll figure it out. 5.5 months later, she finally says, well, I have to quit because you're not paying me. And he said, well, you're only worth $2.75 anyway. Right? So this woman did not make minimum wage, right? You do the math, $2.75 divided. And again, it's just common practice.
But can't
in
she
the
go somewhere
industry.
To say, I've been cheated, this guy's
well,
been paying
she's
the
filed
wage.
A complaint with the State Department of Labor. She's yeah. got a lawyer. They filed a claim, but it's been 6 months and she still doesn't have her wages back.
And so, if you're making $275 an hour, it's probably not an expensive lawyer unless it's somebody who wants to do this as a
absolutely.
As a cost,
it's
right?
a yeah. huge problem.
Well, you know, when it comes to wage theft, not all states are the same. We've invited Mandy Locke, who's a reporter for the NNO, has covered wage theft here in North Carolina to join us now. Mandy, welcome back to the program. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
You investigated a wage theft case in North Carolina. Describe the piece you did for the NNO.
Well, our piece was primarily focused on the issue of misclassification, which you mentioned in the introduction here. And what that means is that an employer is treating their worker as an independent contractor instead of a direct employee, or simply just paying them off the books. Some people are issuing 1099s for independent contractors, but a lot of them are just simply cutting them a check or paying them cash under the table at the end of the work week. And what that means for the employee is that they're often without workers' comp insurance. For the employer, it's a huge savings of cost. They avoid paying certain state and federal taxes. And what we ended up finding in this report was that essentially in North Carolina, two types of businesses have emerged, those who play by the rules and those who don't. And businesses that are trying to do it legally are suffering immensely.
Well, I would think they're at a huge competitive disadvantage if you're playing by the rules, right? You're paying more. So you're when you bid that contract, you got to come in high.
Absolutely.
Well, that's you have a case like that in your book, the case of Stan Merrick in Texas, right?
Stan Merrick, a very wonderful, ethical businessman, does construction work, and he is mad about this issue of wage theft because his competitors are paying 30% less because they're not paying payroll taxes and workers' comp and unemployment insurance. And really, he can't compete. So it's really undermining his business. And I think that's true a lot in residential construction. I've heard it in landscaping. Again, the sectors where it's common practice to steal wages. But I think it's not only bad for those businesses, but it means that the bulk of the responsibility for some of these workers falls on the rest of us. It means if they show up at a hospital, you know, they're probably going to get some care, but, you know, it's going to come out of sort of public coverage in a way that really shifts the burden from those employers to the public sector. It's really unfair to workers, unfair to ethical employers, but really unfair to the public coffers.
Well, part of the public responsibility in this would be oversight. And how does that work? And in North Carolina, for instance, Mandy, what do they do about this? Isn't there a state agency that's supposed to make sure you're obeying the law?
You know, Frank, it's simply just not working. I mean, the best illustration that we were able to come up with is that our agencies each own a piece of this. One agency is responsible for a minimum wage payment or overtime payment. Another is responsible for payment of unemployment taxes, collection of unemployment taxes. And so you have these agencies working in silos, and they're not communicating, not sharing information at all. For instance, I tracked a case that came up at the Industrial Commission, which dispenses of workers' comp claims. And even though in the process of their adjudication, they discovered that this employer was not paying unemployment, he had misclassified his worker, treating him as an independent contractor, but no one from that agency flagged that case for anybody, their counterparts over at the Department of Revenue or the Unemployment Tax Agency either. So they're all just sort of looking at these cases individually in isolated ways.
Are there enough enforcers in the state?
I could say no. Certainly in terms of wage and hour, you have about 20 enforcement staff for the whole state. That's not enough. At the federal level, you have about 1,000 enforcement staff for 135 million workers. Again, it's not enough. So we clearly need to have more people doing enforcement. But we've also got to give them the tools to make it a meaningful consequence if you break the law. So, I mean, if I run a red light and there's no consequences, well, I might do it again, right? You know, I recently turned right at a stoplight in Chicago that had those little cameras, and I had to pay a $100 fine. I'm telling you, I'm not doing that again. But if you steal wages, probably the worst thing that's going to happen is you'll have to pay the wages back that you should have paid in the first place. There seldom are fines. There's seldom consequences. And so employers know that the worst thing will happen is they'll have to pay what they should have paid. So why not? Why not? So we've got to strengthen enforcement. So what a number of states have been doing is they're finding ways to pull people's business license, right? You break the law in this stuff, you're going to lose your license. Well, all of a sudden you start seeing enforcement. In San Francisco, they have actually a citywide ordinance whereby if restaurants don't pay workers their wages, they lose their restaurant license. Well, you can imagine, you know, they start complying right away. So again, we've got to find some creative tools to give those enforcement agencies so that there are meaningful consequences.
It does seem, though, that leverage has a lot to do with this. If I'm a restaurateur in San Francisco, I'm not moving. That's a good place to be a restaurateur. You've got me. But if I'm doing some kind of industrial business in some Midwestern state, I'm going to threaten you. If you crack down on us, we're leaving. And now what do I do as a politician?
Well, again, I think there's a lot of threats that happen like that. And if we have enforcement across the board, then we have a level playing field for all the employers. And that's really what we need. We need a level playing field for everybody. So it's routine and regular enforcement for everyone.
Mandy, could you tell if, and Kim, I'm going to ask you this question nationally, but here in the state of North Carolina, if regulation has gotten tougher, weaker over time, both enforcement, the tools of enforcement, and the fines and the penalties?
You know, Frank, we have a lot of rules on the books here. It's not a matter, I don't think, of coming up with a whole nother batch of laws. I mean, you know, people will say, we have enough regulations, we have enough going on. And frankly, it's not a matter of that. It's a matter of enforcing what's already there on the book. We have a lot of penalties to force businesses to pay workers' comp insurance. But unfortunately, when they fine these businesses, no one follows up to collect the penalties. And I don't think that in North Carolina specifically, it's a matter of boots on the ground. We have a fair number of investigators here, but the problem is that they're dealing with limited information. So right now in North Carolina, there's a task force that's been convened after our series to look at ways that the agencies can share information so that they're making educated guesses. So if a trucking company has registered a fleet of 50 vehicles and they're not paying any unemployment insurance, somebody can see that there's an anomaly in how this business, his employer, is representing himself and taking responsibilities.
Kim, there's a remarkable case, I think, in Florida when it comes to enforcement and the minimum wage law. I was shocked to read how the state of Florida has managed to let really businesses get away with murder.
Well, in Florida, the state legislature voted out their Department of Labor completely. And so there was no, you know, they raised the minimum wage above the federal level, and then they voted out the Department of Labor that would have enforced it, which was nuts, right?
Well, but let me just stop you there kind of to make this point. There's a federal minimum wage, and the law says if the state wage is higher than that, then you pay the state wage because that's higher. We like that. And by the way, then the state will enforce it. So they raise the minimum wage and then take out the enforcement agency.
Yeah, that's
clever.
Exactly what happened. And then the other thing that happened, so then folks in Dade County, which is Miami area, created their own enforcement mechanism, really a really cost-effective agency in the small business office that helps low-wage workers collect their unpaid wages, right? And it had fines, and so it's self-funding, right? So in the first year with one staff person completely funded with fines, you know, it helped collect about $800,000 in back wages and another $750,000 in the pipeline. So again, very effective, makes sense. At which point, then the state legislature this past spring said, oh, well, we want to preempt that and say that they can't create their own enforcement agency at the local level, right? The same state legislature that, you know, voted them out. And the reason was because we think that's a state function.
Well, and also you might want to be more, you might have a group of legislators who are more friendly to business than they are to labor. This might be a political question. Is it from state to state? A state that's more friendly to businesses, less likely to be fierce on enforcement. Other states are a little better because they see their political
You know, I think that is how it is perceived. I think what we're seeing around the country, though, is that ethical business leaders are stepping up and saying, hey, we really do need a a level playing field, and part of that level playing field is making sure that the laws are enforced. And so, again, I think it has been seen and viewed that way sometimes, but I think that's really not the case. And so we are seeing task forces, like she was suggesting, created around the country that really look at this question of payroll fraud, of lying about actually having employees.
And what about workers themselves? Why don't they stay? I mean, if you took that job and you understood that you were going to get less than what you might get over there, why take that job? You have a choice, right?
Well, in this economy where jobs are hard to come by, especially for workers without top skills, it's very vulnerable. I hear workers tell me all the time, you know, Kim, I know my employer is supposed to be paying overtime, but, you know, at least I got a job. Well, and I actually had somebody last week just say to me, well, Kim, isn't that good? Isn't it better to have a job compared to no job? Well, yeah, but that's not really the choice, right? Couldn't we have a job that, like, obeys the law versus a job that doesn't? I, you know, again, I think we've got a yes, people want a job, and so people are vulnerable and stay in situations that aren't fair right now. But that shouldn't be the only option. We ought to be able to have the laws enforced.
Mandy, what were workers telling you throughout the course of your story?
One thing that I observed, which is really saddening, is that another layer to this is that many of the workers, particularly those working in the construction industry, are undocumented. So they had a lot of hesitation to make themselves known in any official capacity. A lot of these workers couldn't appreciate or understand that the Department of Labor's wage and hour investigators wouldn't then in turn report them to immigration officials. They wanted to stay beneath the radar and were willing to make a lot of sacrifices that hurt their economic standpoint in this country, which is really sad.
So, Kim, you mentioned a couple of things that can happen systemically. You said there are ethical business leaders who are taking the lead, asking for a level playing field. There are places like Dade County and San Francisco that are taking the initiative themselves. What about, is there a need to strengthen workers' leverage so that they can be their own agents in this question?
Absolutely. I do believe that one of the reasons we have this drastic increase in wage theft around the country, one of the factors is the fact that we don't have very many unions in the country any longer. In a place like North Carolina, you have very few. But the decline in unions around the country, I think, has been an exacerbating force for wage theft because you have no institution at the local level to help workers fight back. If you have a union in the workplace, you're probably not going to have wage theft. And so what we're seeing around the country is really the creation of some new structures to protect workers. There are about 200 worker centers in the country that have kind of emerged as they're kind of like the settlement houses at the turn of the century, right? Jane Addams, Hull House, and so forth, or like the Catholic labor schools of the 30s and 40s or the Jewish labor lyceums of that same period, right? They're structures that help workers who've been cheated or taken advantage of. You know, there's one in Morganton, North Carolina. There's conversations about a new one here in Carrboro, right? So there's some efforts to try and build worker centers in North Carolina as well. I think they're very important new structures.
You are part of an interfaith network. What do faith communities have to do with this? What role do they have to play?
Well, you know, the faith community has always cared deeply about poverty issues, right? And we know that people are poor because they either don't have jobs or they don't have jobs that pay enough. And increasingly, when people learn that the average low-wage worker loses $2,600 a year in unpaid wages, people are like, whoa, that's not right. And, you know, for most of us, if we memorize the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal. Well, you know, that includes wages. And so people are really eager to figure out how we can do more to fight this crime.
I want to thank you both for being on the program, Mandy and Kim. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks.
Mandy Locke, reporter for the NNO in Raleigh. Kim Bobos, executive director of Interfaith Worker Justice and author of several books, including Wage Theft in America. She'll be speaking tomorrow night at Duke University Divinity School, 6:30 in room 14. Coming up, the tragic history of eugenics in North Carolina, told in a new stage production. Stay with us on The State of Things.